Sermons are funny things. One of the things that they are is a game of connect the dots. And the preacher has to figure out how to connect the dots. And I hope I'll do that today with the Matthew passage, the feature. The Psalm text is marvelous, but I'm not going to address it at all. You heard it read. You can have it as a backdrop. It's not that it's unconnected. Specifically in the Matthew account, the key passages are verses 12 and 13. There are the pivot points of the maidens with their lamps. Now, we've found ourselves in the last decade plus since September 11th in a kind of state of ready alert. We had early on in the Bush administration the yellow, amber, somewhat close to red, and then red alerts of when there was going to be some attack that might be coming. I don't think that's a bad thing, and I guess we still have it in some modified form, although it's been being used less and less, I hope not to our disaster and dismay. We know what we go through when we go to airports, how we get screened, concerns about whether we're living in a security state of email monitoring our telephone calls, emails, and other. Although, quite frankly, there were loads of people who thought the same thing, including Martin Luther King back in the 1960s. So it's not as though that's a thing that has just happened in the last decade or thereabouts. Bad people, bad things to be feared. You might have thought, looking at the sermon title, that, oh my God, here we go, it's another, where are we with Ebola today? Ebola is a horrible, horrible thing in countries in Africa, and it's terrible, and it's frightening. And we need to be doing everything we can from here, including sending our people and having them come back, and I guess now not having to go through the kinds of quarantines and whatnot that a couple of weeks ago seemed to be de rigueur. More fear, more concern over nothing. I had a student yesterday in class. She works in an elementary school, I think, in Mansfield, a study that's talking about global issues. She happens to have a study that she's projecting about the degree to which elementary school teachers include global things in their educational plans, which is, I think, a good thing to be trying to research. And I was making comments about, when was the last time a second grade teacher said anything about Putin or Netanyahu or where is Iraq in their second grade class? And she said, and I mentioned Ebola, and she said, believe it or not, we've got little posters that say, here are the symptoms of Ebola in our elementary class. In our town, in suburban Boston. Kind of ridiculous in a lot of ways. And for those of us, I know some of you, I won't name names, grew up in this era, as I did, of the scare and threat about nuclear holocaust, nuclear attack from the then Soviet Union, back in the 50s and 60s. Some of you probably did as I did, with a duck and cover, get under your desk at school, go into the hall. We did these drills. I lived 13 miles outside of Center City, Philadelphia, 8 miles from the oil refineries, if you've ever traveled down 95 and across the bridges there, and it makes our little gas tanks here look like nothing. One of the biggest oil refineries probably on the East Coast. And we were 8-9 miles as the crow flew from there. You can imagine if the Soviets had Philadelphia targeted, they weren't going to target Billy Penn at the top of City Hall. They were going to target the Navy Yard and those tanks that were 8 miles from where my home was. But in my school, we were going to go into the hallway and get up against the wall and shelter ourselves from the bomb. It was going to blast off. There were people in my community who built bomb shelters. I happened to see one of them. There were only two or three. It was almost absurd when you look at it, you know, now, maybe even then, that it was a box. I guess it had oxygen coming from somewhere through filters, but what's going to filter radioactive air? And the guy was whether he actually wouldn't tell the media or his neighbors whether he actually had a gun so that he could defend his shelter from some neighbor that might try to get in there with him, in it. It was kind of a constant state of alert. A dear friend of my parents, who lived actually up the hill from the guy with the fallout shelter, a rather humorous guy, an anesthesiologist, I don't know whether that had to do with his solution to the issue of if the bombs went off, and he said, you know, if they tell us that the Russian missiles or their airplanes are in the first mushroom cloud in downtown Philadelphia or somewhere else, I will get my bottle of scotch and I will start walking towards Center City. And that actually probably was a smart idea. And whether Ray Davis would have actually done that or not, I don't know. He was a humorous guy, but he was also a serious man. And I guess maybe Ray Davis's lamp oil was a bottle of scotch. Sounds like Obama's lamp oil is a bourbon at the hands of Mitch McConnell. And it was a joke there. And we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, and you thought that every plane that was flying over was maybe a Russian jet about to drop bombs. So the whole issue when we get into that kind of apocalyptic thinking, and this text today has its apocalyptic aspect. And the lectionary, which I am following, and Chris followed last week, and I guess often does, or almost always does, I always do, lectionary year, coming to the end of the lectionary year, which begins in three Sundays from now with Advent. Well, the lectionary year gets into the end, and the end times and texts about the end times, because we're coming to the end of the lectionary year. And then we get to Advent, and we start thinking about the birth of Jesus and new life and so forth. So we're in this time in the lectionary, where it's, in a sense, about the apocalypse, about the end times. Of course, the question is, how much can we take? How much could we take of the red alerts, yellow alerts, and so forth? How much Ebola alarm can we take? So the question is, what hope, if any, does Jesus offer us in the face of that kind of aspect of our lives? Now, there's a bunch of problems in this Matthew account. I say problems, things that I would rather not tell you, but I'm going to tell you, because the preacher has an obligation to tell you. One is that we have an image of Jesus here, which is not the kind, little, gentle baby Jesus. It's not the Jesus of giving forgiveness to people. It's not the Jesus of raising Lazarus. It's not the Jesus of let me rub oil on your feet or wash your feet or something else. It's the Jesus who, when the door is locked on the foolish maidens, says, I don't know you. The presumption there is the door doesn't get open. Nothing that tells us that the door gets opened. So the foolish maidens are shut out. And we don't normally like to think of Jesus as somebody who shuts people out, who bars the door. But here he bars the door. And I don't think we have any real good way around that. There's one maybe little piece of wiggle room that I'll mention around that, but it's not an image of Jesus that we normally. Religion professor had a wonderful religion professor at Gettysburg. You know, it was the how do you get your eyes open by Old and New Testament critical approach to the scriptures and whatnot, who used to say the Bible isn't one thing, it's many things, which is his way of saying the Bible conflicts with itself. There are arguments in there that are unresolved, and so forth. It is the Word of God, and I love the children's sermon, and maybe they should be up here preaching. They were much better than I. They're much more theologically tuned in than I am. But the reality is the Word of God is many things. here we have a Jesus, not Jesus is many things. Jesus is not one thing, Jesus is many things. And here's a side of Jesus that is not sort of, if you will, the norm of the welcoming, caring, compassionate, forgiving, if you will, Jesus. Not very forgiving about the foolish maidens. So here we are with Apocalypse. Here we are with the end of the liturgical year in the lectionary. And interestingly, here we are with Providence Presbyterian Church at the end of its little journey, which has been more than a year. And so there's a question about whether we've got oil in our lamps. Do we still have oil in our lamps here? Or have we used it all up, or did we not have any to begin with, as we now anticipate the coming of a new co-pastor? I would hope that she wouldn't find us without any oil in our lamps. And I would hope that she wouldn't bar the door if she did. I haven't met her, but I understand she's a very wonderful, decent, lovely person, so I'll hope for myself, but that's not the case. Now, so we got problem number one is this image of Jesus. And then we got problem number two of this notion of watching, being prepared. And there the red alert is pretty real, because Jesus basically says, essentially he's saying you weren't prepared. You didn't have enough oil. Also note, interestingly, the other maidens aren't real nice Christian people. They don't get into sharing here. They say, we don't have enough to share with you. Go get your own. And then when they, of course, why then the door can be barred from them when they come back now with their oil, but it's too late. So we've got this watching, be prepared theme here in Matthew. And that's where the story of the bridesmaids really gets traction. It is a parable about the wise, pardon me, the wise and the foolish. And after all, presumably, we would want to be the wise in the wise. We would want to be the wise maidens here in this account if we were in it. It's about people being left behind, shut out. Presumably, we'd prefer not to be the people knocking on the door trying to get in. And certainly not the people that would have Jesus saying, I don't know you. I don't know you individually, or I don't know you as a group. So think about that for a moment. The core ground, if you will, of that Matthew verse 12 in chapter 25. Even think about verse 13 in chapter 25 about you don't know the time or the place. If we're to think about apocalypse, if we're to think about end times, what even does that say about what we should be doing, about whether, what can we really know about whether we might be in some end times? And if we did think that somehow we were in some end times, my wife reminded me a couple of weeks ago when I was preparing this, she said, well, you know, this really is about, you know, you can't dodge the fact that the early church, the early Christians felt that they were living in that time. You know, you lose your leader, you're under duress, you're under oppression, you'd probably start thinking that. And there are all manner of nice start prophets and whatnot in the Old Testament that we can start playing with. And other number games with, that some groups have played in Daniel and other places with figuring out the exact day. At least the year, but maybe even the month and maybe even the day and the month. Because we read something in Daniel or we connected it with something in Revelation and we played some kind of a game. And I don't want to bore you with it, but there are straw people that I can put up. Those who are American religious historians or other, there were the wonderful Millerites in the 1840s. They were among the first to go get the white robes and go out on a hill because they thought they knew the day. And the 1840s, in this country to a certain extent, but also in Europe, were very, very tough times. The revolutions of 1848 racked Europe the way a lot of people say today, oh my God, look at what's happening in Middle East and in Europe and Ukraine and so forth. We've never seen anything like this. Now, people in the 1840s in the United States and in Europe thought the world was coming to an end. Talk to anybody in the early 1900s, in the 19, you know, we're about to celebrate Veterans Day, which was set off after World War, the armistice that was established after World War I, the war to end all wars. What did people think in 1911, 1912, 1913, as the world was marching toward what became, for them, the war to end all wars? And it was a pretty horrible and messy war. So the Millerites go out on the hills. We had a couple of years ago this guy who thought he knew the end. I can't remember his name, but he actually, I think, had a reboot and did it twice or maybe even three times, and now he's kind of disappeared. I don't think we hear about him anymore. He'll come back. I don't know. And I got into a discussion with my brother-in-law a couple of weeks ago, who was here on the occasion of the memorial service of the death of my mother-in-law, my brother-in-law. He is of a sect that my wife was raised in, can't bore you with this, called Christadelphians. And they are, among other things, end-time folks. And David started going down the path of, we're living in the end times. And here's why. And he started to try to tell me why. And he's quoting from Revelation and Daniel and all this. And then he's telling me that he's got this article from Isaac Newton from the 1770s or 1780s about the end times, which then sort of began to prove my point. And I said to him, David, people have been thinking this for a long time. And what I didn't get a chance to talk with him about, and it would have been probably a somewhat nettlesome argument, so I kind of ran it by my spouse, who kind of knows that approach and that theology. And I said, so suppose we're in the end times, what difference does it make? Does that make us do something different? It's sort of the foxhole religion. Or I get a dreaded terminal disease, and then all of a sudden I'm going to hit my bucket list because I've got cancer. As opposed to, well, I'm living today, what would I do today? Rather than if I'm in a foxhole, or I really do believe that I'm in the end times. Like, Jesus is coming back and the whole world's going to spin apart next month. And she said, well, you would have more of a sense of urgency. Okay. Maybe my brother-in-law was trying to tell me that we'd have more of a sense of urgency. Maybe that would mean that you go try to radically convert people quickly so they could be ready and maybe get their robes on when Jesus was going to come back after all the mess. For me, and I would postulate for you, I don't know that that stuff makes any difference. It's not that we ignore that there could be an end time and that the whole thing could spin apart, or we could choke ourselves in global something, climate change and warming, or something else. I'm not naive, and I'm not trying to propose that. But what I am trying to say is, so how much does that be prepared? Does that mean we have to somehow be prepared differently than we would be prepared regardless of whether we thought the end was this close or the end is out here centuries or eons from now? I'm not sure that makes any difference. And I've given you a couple of straw people, with all due respect to my brother-in-law, who's a delightful guy, but you know, he operates very strongly out of that position. That drive, where that, I don't know how or where that gets him. That was sort of my question. I don't know where that gets you. But it seems to get him somewhere. It helps him make sense out of something. So admittedly, there's some sense of urgency in here. But I think the question is the degree to which that urgency matters in the sense that all of a sudden we're going to change ourselves up in response to it. So we go back to the wedding feast. People with oil, without oil, the prepared versus the unprepared. As I said a moment ago, we want to be the former, we don't want to be the latter. We want to be prepared. We want Jesus to see us as prepared. So what do we do? What are our lamps? What's your lamp? What's my lamp? What's our oil for our lamps? Whatever it is we think our lamps are. And how do we have all that with us and ready. You need to have it ready because this passage would tell you that you need to have it ready at hand. And if you don't, pardon me, you're screwed. Gonna get. Because then the door's gonna get shut. Because you weren't ready. You weren't prepared. I think this is less about call in the conventional sense of call. Am I called to go do something? Than being prepared for whatever it is that might come along. Slight, it's a marginal difference, but I think it's a critical difference. Because it isn't, oh, what am I called to go do? But it's more, I'm sitting here in real time. And what's coming across the radar screen? Where am I? Who am I interacting with? And am I prepared for whatever it is I should be prepared for in that moment? This is a moment. These folks are at a bridal feast, waiting for the bridegroom to arrive in the parable. So I think it's about what are the challenges, what are the things that we might confront in maybe unexpected ways, and what are we going to do about that? Now, Chris, I thought I was going to write her an email this week because I think the sermon last week was marvelous. In a simplistic, and I say that with all absolute respect, in an absolutely wonderfully simplistic way about the saints. And the saints that are here in our midst. Now, there are saints other places, too. And we can't get self-absorbed about naming each other saints and saying, well, you're one, I think, and if you want to tell me I'm one, that's nice. And I don't think that's what Chris was saying. But the saints are the people who are prepared. The saints, they're stuff that comes across the radar screen, they're prepared. They've got some response that's growing out of their Christian faith stance, their belief stance, their affirmation, their spirituality, their conviction, their Christian faith conviction. And she named a few names, and, you know, you always leave somebody behind. She named a few names last week. I won't rename them. But there are a number that, and I think she was alluding to this in this congregation, that regularly go out to places and give of their time and give of their talents to things elsewhere in the world, sometimes even in this country, in this congregation. Gina Bay is a goddess for what she did in the pastoral search process here. She's a saint. She's a saint for how long that took and what it took to get us to where we got to with it. The Ramses, when Glenn announced almost offhand a month ago or so that we're leaving to go to Mexico to this church that needs us. And I thought, boy, God bless you, but if some church in Mexico needed me, I could not pick myself up and go do that. I might, if somebody could promise me a tennis game on the ground 7 days a week with somebody in that little village in Mexico. But I couldn't do that. So we've got that kind of commitment out of folks who I think are our own midst here, of people who I think show us the way of what it is to be prepared, what it is to have our spirits, our hearts prepared so that literally and figuratively we're not caught naked or we're not caught with no oil in our lamps. It's preparation. It is about being on alert. Now, whether it's a feeling of constant red alert of what Jesus and God might be throwing at it is, I don't know. But it is a question about being on some degree of alert. So we need to know what our vessel or what our vessels is or are, individually and corporately, as a church body and congregation, but specifically for each of us as congregants and believers. Is it our bodies? It is our lives lived out on some level? Is it the specific places that our ourselves operating, our professions, the places that we live and have our being, the contacts, the relationships that we have with people? Maybe it's our wallets. Maybe it's our time. So we have to be prepared We have to be prepared to use what we have, the oil in our lamps. That is our challenge. That is something to which I think we somehow need to be committed. So let's see how ready we are in the days and months and weeks and years ahead. Amen.